Her daughter, Charles would say. They had the same conversations many times. I'd used to wonder why my mother had gone away if she was so concerned for my welfare. This particular row took place 20 years later, when Charles and Marion were in the lounge and I was in the breakfast room preparing the next day's lessons. What have I done? Marion hissed, for what must have been the 6th or 7th time. You haven't done anything, Charles replied. I visualized him giving an indifferent shrug. Then why are you being so cold with me?
I'm not aware I'm being cold.
Well, you are, and it's not fair, Charles. You have no right to behave like this and refuse to tell me why.
That's because there isn't a why.
Oh, don't be stupid. I'm going to bed.
Good night, Charles said indifferently.
Good night, Marion slammed the door. I told Rob about the ongoing quarrel on Saturday night. We went to the Chinese restaurant in Bow Street, where I'd been with Uncle Harry. The food and wine were just as good, and there was a nice atmosphere. I had my usual curried prawns and rice. Rob was more adventurous and chose mini portions of 6 different things. We chatted about school. Kathy Burns had fascinated him. She looks like a typical headmistress, yet she's got this look in her eye. He left the sentence unfinished. I didn't tell him that she had been just as fascinated with him. I said that since Monday, Gary had been basking in the glow of his father's magnificent exhibition of ball control. He's been invited to 2 parties, as he told you.
Yes, he looked worried. What am I supposed to do?
Buy presents, obviously, but do I send cakes and stuff? He pulled a horrified face. I won't be expected to stay and help with the games, will I?
I assured him a present was quite enough and that he wouldn't have to stay. I asked when it was Gary's birthday and he said he would be 6 in January.
I wonder where we'll be then.
He stared at his plate as if the future was mapped out there.
I'm in 2 minds about going back to the police. It's a good job, the pay's decent, but the hours are lousy if you're a single parent.
I still fancy going abroad, but so far nothing's come up that would suit me. I still have hopes of Canada.
Gary said you went to look at a house in Manchester.
He wrinkled his nose. I must have been mad. I'd seen a job advertised, but the wages were hopeless. Common sense dawned on the train there, and I came straight home again.
Trouble is, I truly don't know what to do with the rest of my life,
and Gary's life. We'd reached the pudding stage. I said I couldn't eat any more, and Rob declared himself full. He ordered coffee, and as soon as it arrived, he looked at me expectantly. I duly told him the story of my life. When I finished, he looked so stunned that it was a while before he could bring himself to speak. When he did, it was to admit that he didn't know what to say. Other than, I'm flabbergasted, struck all of a heap, as my mother would have said.
I've brought a photo. I took out of my bag the photograph from the file. This is of my parents at their wedding. The newspapers used it during the trial.
They'd gone straight from the wedding to a photographer's. They were standing stiffly, linking arms, yet the wide grins on both their faces were wildly at odds with their formal pose.
Wow, Rob said. They look happy.
Don't they? My mother was only 18, and my father 21. They got married without telling anyone.
They look like a Hollywood couple. I can see where you get your looks from. You're the spitting image of your dad.
Everyone says that, I sighed. I'd much rather take after my mother.
Have you got a photo of Jenny?
He brought out a wallet and showed me a small photograph. I took this the day before she drowned. We were on a beach near Barcelona. They thought it was cramp. The photo showed a pretty brown-haired girl wearing a gold Alice band, a bright red halter top and white shorts. Unlike my photo, it was in colour. She was kneeling on the sand with 2-year-old Gary leaning against her. I remember him saying his mum's eyes were green, but this wasn't apparent from the photo. The woman was smiling directly at the camera, presumably at Rob, her husband, and looked as if she hadn't a care in the world.
She looks happy too, I said. The world would be a pretty terrible place if we knew what was in store for us, Rob said. Fortunately, Jenny didn't know she'd be dead less than 24 hours after that was taken. And my parents didn't know that the day would eventually come when one would murder the other. The night out with Rob couldn't really be described as enjoyable, but it wasn't disagreeable either. I suppose cathartic was the right word. It was the first time in my life that I'd told another person about the tragedy of my parents, and I felt better afterwards. I don't think I could have confided in a more understanding person, and that helped a lot. We'd come to Liverpool in our own cars and had agreed to leave them in the car park in St. John's Market, though they were on different floors. Rob walked with me to mine. When we reached it, he shook my hand and said he'd had a nice time. I wasn't sure whether to be glad or sorry that he hadn't kissed me, but then he pulled me towards him and kissed my cheek. I still wasn't sure how I felt. Would I ever? He said he was taking Gary to Southport tomorrow afternoon, and would I care to come with them? I expect you won't want to, he said hurriedly. After all, you're dealing with other people's kids all week long. Weekends, you'll be glad to see the back of them. I really like Gary, I said. I'd love to see both of you tomorrow. Good, he looked pleased. Shall I pick you up at about one? I'd planned to go earlier, but I promised I'd give Bess a hand with the garden after Mass. I hope you're not cutting down trees or anything like that, I said. It's the nicest garden I've ever been in. No, but it needs weeding. Next door have complained about them coming through the fence. That's all right, then. I'd better give you my address. I had a letter from Trish in my bag. She hated London and longed to be back in Liverpool. I gave the envelope to Rob. See you tomorrow, he said, taking it. I, too, had something to do after Mass. Hilda Dooley's flat purchase was progressing like a dream. It belonged to an old lady, Mrs. Edmonds, who had already gone to live with her daughter, and as Hilda didn't have a property to sell and had already been offered a mortgage, there was nothing to hold up the proceedings. Mrs. Edmonds had even let her have the key, and she invited me to have a look at the place. I can have any furniture that I want, Hilda told me as she showed me round. So I said I'd have the lot. It really suits the place, much better than the modern stuff would. Everything's just as I want it. Clifford Thompson and Mrs. Dooley were already there. Almost owning her own home and having a boyfriend had done Hilda the world of good. Everyone in school kept remarking on how well she looked. Somehow her thin hair looked thicker, and even her buck teeth didn't seem to stick out quite so much. Mrs. Dooley wore a slinky black frock and black lace tights, which made her look like mutton dressed up as lamb. I marvelled at how well Hilda and Clifford were getting on. I'm pretty certain they'd slept together. There was an intimacy between them. Their hands touched a lot, and they exchanged quick little glances. You'd think they'd known each other forever. The flat was lovely. It looked Victorian inside as well as out. I loved the fancy tiled fireplace in the odd-shaped lounge that wasn't quite square, and the ancient bathroom with its arched window. Normally I didn't like old-fashioned furniture. It was often too big and cumbersome. But the top floor of the old house had low ceilings and narrow stairs and could only accommodate furniture I would describe as bijou. The tiny kitchen needed a complete overhaul, but Hilda was leaving it until she'd saved enough to have it done. She was obviously revelling in her role as hostess and soon-to-be owner of a property in one of the best positions in Liverpool. From the living room window, the River Mersey could be seen twinkling less than a mile away. I soon understood why Hilda had invited her mother. She was making up for all the years her mother had made her feel small. Now she was the one on top, the one with the handsome boyfriend and the lovely home. I wouldn't be surprised if Hilda and Clifford didn't announce they were shortly getting married. Perversely, I couldn't help but feel sorry for Mrs. Dooley. She looked really pathetic in her sexy clothes and didn't open her mouth once. I told Charles and Marion when I got home that someone was coming to collect me and we were going to Southport. It's one of the fathers from school with his little boy, I said. Charles raised an eyebrow. And what about the father from school's wife?
She's dead.
How old is he? He sounds old.
He's 28, I said. Only 3 years older than me.
Do you like him?
Am I likely to go to Southport with someone I didn't like?
I suppose not, Charles conceded.
Can I be doing something outside when he comes, like cutting the hedge, so I have a good look at him?
If you want. So when Rob and Gary arrived, Charles was snipping away at the privet hedge that had been trimmed over the years to a perfect wavy line. I often saw people admiring Charles's hedge, and wondered if some came from quite far away. Perhaps the hedge had become a tourist attraction. Rob had the window down, and Charles bent and wished him good morning. Rob said, "Hello there." I opened the passenger door. It made even more noise than the one on the other side, and I saw it only had one hinge. I don't know why I giggled. Everyone else I knew had perfectly respectable cars. It was a lovely day out. We played football on the shore, had turns on some of the milder fairground rides, and walked up and down the pier. It was where my mother and father had met, and I couldn't help but wonder where exactly the spot was. Had my mother been sitting on a bench or leaning on the railings, looking down at the water? I pictured her walking along with Kathy, both carrying ice creams. We had afternoon tea in Lord Street, then went to the pictures to see Woody Allen in Bananas. Gary didn't understand a word of it, but laughed himself sick, and Rob and I went far behind. In view of Rob being so hard up, I insisted on paying for a meal when we came out.
"It's not right," Rob complained.
"Don't be daft," I snorted. I took hold of Gary's hand and entered a classy-looking restaurant, leaving his father with no alternative but to follow. "It's ludicrous and dead old-fashioned, you paying for everything just because you're a man," I said, after we were seated. "I pay a pittance for my keep, so have most of my wages for myself. Haven't you heard of feminism?"
"I have, yes, but I've never met a feminist."
"Unless you're one." I confessed I didn't know if I was or not. On the way home, Gary fell asleep in the back seat, by which time it had grown dark. I felt conscious of Rob's bare arm touching mine whenever he changed gear. "It's been a good day," he said. I agreed that it had. He went on, "Perhaps we could do it again one day soon." I agreed to that as well, and he suggested the following Saturday. "We could go to Chester Zoo. Gary would love it." I said, "Okay," not caring that being free two Saturdays in a row indicated I led a pretty lousy social life.
"Would your feelings be hurt if we went in my car?" I asked.
Rob said he'd be cut to the quick, but if I was worried about being seen in his pile of junk, then we'd go in mine. "You can pick me up. What sort of car have you got?"
"A Volkswagen Beetle, bright red. It's only 2 years old."
I was buying it on hire purchase. It had been Charles's idea because it was an interest-free loan or something.
"Wow," Rob was impressed. "I told you I wasn't short of a few bob."
"Back in Uganda, I drove a brand new Jeep. I bought this for 150 quid just to get me around while I sorted myself out." He slapped the steering wheel of the Morris. He stopped outside the house in Aintree and once again kissed my cheek. "Like I said, it's been a good day," he murmured. I went indoors to find Marion in bed and Charles waiting for me to come in so he could have a good moan. That was the day when it seemed their marriage had broken down, possibly forever. Apparently, it was all the fault of Rob's car.
Chapter 12, 1940, Barney and Amy. Barney never forgot the sense of total desolation and despair he felt as he watched his brother and his brother's friend hobble away in the direction of Dunkirk. With a sigh, he started up the engine of the lorry. He could think of plenty of reasons for turning around and going with the two men. He'd misunderstood his orders, he could say. The lorry had broken down. He'd had an accident, been knocked unconscious, and when he came to, found himself on the boat to England without any idea of how he'd got there. He'd already lost his driver, who'd caught a bullet in the shoulder when he'd got out to relieve himself, and the convoy had been strafed. He'd been left in Dunkirk with the other injured men, and now Barney had to make his way back to his unit on his own. He wouldn't be at all surprised to find it had been sent elsewhere by the time he arrived at Saint-Valery-en-Caux, where it had been heading when he was appointed to take a dozen badly injured men to Dunkirk. Saint-Valery-en-Caux was about 100 miles away, and all sorts of different orders might have been issued in his absence. What was he supposed to do then? It didn't help that the journey was taking forever. The road was packed with refugees going in the opposite direction, from the very young to the very old, getting as far away as they could from the advancing German army. He could only edge along, not prepared to sound his horn and distress these already wretched people even more. Until recently, most had led quite ordinary lives. Now they were carrying their most precious possessions stuffed in suitcases or sacks, tiny children clutching their hands or held in their arms, horses strained to pull carts with far too many passengers. Prams were laden with parcels of bedding and clothes. The way he had to crawl along, stopping and starting, reminded him of coming back from London that time with Amy. Then he'd cursed the traffic, called it all the names under the sun. But it was nothing compared to this. At least he'd been heading for home, and he'd had Amy at his side. He remembered arriving at the flat feeling sick, Amy helping him into bed, bathing his brow, making him tea, lying beside him and reminding him of how much she loved him. Amy. Barney turned the lorry into a narrow country lane that was entirely devoid of traffic. He braked, and his shoulders sagged. It was as if he'd moved from a relatively peaceful world into a cruel, violent one, with different standards, where human life had lost all its value. "Phew," he said very loudly. He withdrew from the breast pocket of his shirt a fountain pen and a little notebook with a bright red cover. At least a quarter of the pages were full of his tiny, neat print. It was a diary, and one of these days he would send it to Amy. He wrote the date in the side column, followed by, "Delivered 12 injured men to Dunkirk to be taken to England. Met Harry and his friend Jack on way back. Feel sad, very hungry." He chewed the pen for a minute, then wrote, "Very thirsty. Love you more than all the tea in China, my darling Amy." He was aware that the last bit didn't make sense, but she would know what he meant. It was stupid, but the act of stopping the lorry had made him feel light-headed and dizzy. He really was exceptionally hungry and thirsty, having given all the supplies to the injured men. What's more, he hadn't slept since yesterday morning. All he had on him was a packet of senior service. A cigarette wouldn't help with his hunger or his thirst, but it would soothe his nerves. But the cab of the lorry was too hot. He climbed out and sat on the side of the road, in the shade of a bright green hedge covered with white blossom. It smelt tangy and fresh, and felt cool when he leant against it. It was quiet here, and possible to forget, or pretend to forget, where he was and what was happening in this part of the world. He didn't hear the plane approach. It appeared out of nowhere, its engine deafening as it swooped over him, barely 12 feet above his head, before he had time to move. There was a series of spitting noises, followed by screams. Then the plane roared away, having done what it had set out to do. Barney took a final puff of the cigarette and threw it away. He would never, no matter how long he lived, understand the mentality of the Jerry pilots, who were capable of strafing helpless refugees. He climbed back into the lorry's cab. A line of bullets had punctured the canvas awning, and one had gone right through the jacket that he'd left on the driver's seat. Had he not got out to have a smoke, he would be dead. The screaming persisted. The road behind would be stained with blood. People would have been killed and injured. This couldn't be true. It wasn't real. It could only be part of the worst nightmare he'd ever had. Numbly, he jumped out of the lorry again and went to help. By late afternoon, the procession of refugees had been reduced to a few stragglers. Barney was able to get up a moderate speed, but noticed that the lorry would very soon need petrol. If it ran out altogether, it would be a good reason to get out and make for Dunkirk on foot.
except he'd been given the order to rejoin his unit, and it was immaterial how he got there. It didn't matter if he drove or walked, hopped or flew. He came to a crossroads with three or four houses on each corner and stopped. It was a desolate place, without any sign of life. But perhaps there was somewhere he could get a drink. A well, maybe, or an outside tap. His mouth was as dry as a bone. There was very little he wouldn't have traded for a glass of cold water. His tired eyes rested on a single-story building, and he wondered if what he was seeing really existed, or if it was a mirage, the sort of thing people saw when they were lost in the desert and the need for a drink made them hallucinate. A small building had the word bar painted on the window. The door was wide open, and in the gravelled forecourt there was a petrol pump. Barney parked the lorry beside the pump and climbed out. His legs nearly failed him when he tried to stand, but he managed to stagger towards the open door, almost grinning because he reminded himself of Charles Laughton in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Once inside the bar, he stood upright with the aid of a chair. It was a miserable place, with just four small tables, an assortment of chairs and benches, and a wooden counter that served as a bar. He shouted, "Is anyone here?" But there was no reply. Behind the bar, not only were the shelves crammed with bottles of wine, but there was also a dripping tap that made lovely plopping sounds when the water landed in a deep brown earthenware sink. Barney wasn't interested in the wine. He turned the tap full on, seized a mug and filled it. Water had never tasted so delicious. He drank mug after mug before going outside to fill the tank with petrol. Having done this, he drove the lorry round to the rear of the building. He had no intention of leaving the place until he'd had his fill of water and had searched for food. He found a room behind the bar where the owner might well have lived. It had a narrow bunk built underneath the window, a small table, a single chair, and a dresser that took up almost an entire wall. The floor was stone-flagged, and the walls were rough, unpainted plaster. Everywhere was surprisingly clean. Despite Barney's longing for food, he briefly stopped to study the 50 or more books that were stacked tightly on the dresser shelves. Balzac, Flaubert, Verlaine, the works of Shakespeare translated into French, all of Dickens, again in French, some Russian authors. What sort of man had lived in this depressing place, running a bar and spending his free time reading great works? He found a lump of rock-hard bread in one of the dresser cupboards, a piece of cheese, two hard-boiled eggs, and a jar of pickled onions. He sat on the bed and ate everything, twice falling asleep with his mouth full. When he'd finished, he lay down, his thirst quenched and his stomach satisfied. Now all he needed was a little nap, 40 winks, Amy would have said. Then he would continue his journey. The noise in the bar woke him, not surprisingly, as it was quite a racket. Shouting, singing, the stamping of feet and the clink of bottles. The language being spoken was German. Barney heard everything but didn't open his eyes. His heart thudded painfully in his chest as he tried to remember the geography of the room. Where was the back door? Could he escape through it before he was discovered? He could hide somewhere until the troops, they could only be troops, went away. He hoped they hadn't noticed the lorry. Slowly, cautiously, he let his eyes open the merest slit and saw a German soldier standing just inside the door, with his rifle pointed directly at him. Barney opened his eyes properly, slowly lifted his hands above his head in a gesture of surrender, while letting his feet swing onto the floor. Just as slowly he got to his feet, not wanting to frighten the soldier with a sudden movement that might cause him to fire the gun. Neither he nor the soldier, who looked no more than 18, spoke, though Barney was aware of the thunderous beating of his heart. The youngster gestured with his rifle towards the bar. Barney nodded obediently and shuffled towards the door, keeping his eyes fixed on the rifle, as if staring at it would prevent it from being fired. The soldier gave him a poke in the ribs with the barrel of the gun, and they entered the bar, where about a dozen enemy troops had removed their helmets and jackets, thrown their rifles in a heap just inside the door, and were drinking wine from bottles, heads thrown back. Empty bottles stood on the counter and rolled along the floor. They must have been there quite a while. He'd been too fast asleep to hear. The soldier who'd captured him shouted something, and the men stopped drinking, saw Barney, and started to laugh. One came forward, seized his collar at the back, and flung him face down onto the floor. When he tried to rise, a foot was placed none too gently on his head. He lay there, thinking of Amy the first time they met, Amy laughing, Amy crying, holding her in his arms, making love, all the time waiting for a bullet or bayonet to enter his body and finish him off, so he would become just a memory to his wife, his family, and everyone else he knew. But instead of a bullet or a bayonet, he felt warm liquid spilling over him, soaking his legs, his arms, his back, every part of him. The foot was removed, and the liquid poured over his head. They were peeing on him. The smell of it made him want to puke. They were laughing while they did it. One of them, he couldn't see their faces, kicked his leg. Another kick was aimed at his hip, and he was beginning to think it was his fate to be kicked to death, when a harsh voice clapped out an order. Barney couldn't speak German, but it sounded like an order. And the men stopped peeing and kicking and stood to attention, their boots making such a terrible clatter on the stone floor that it made his head ring. Seconds passed. Barney didn't look up. Footsteps approached and stopped right by his ear. A voice said pleasantly, "Stand up!" He stood, urine dripping from his hair. He tried to wipe it away with his sleeve, but his shirt was soaked. The speaker was a handsome man of about 40, wearing the grey uniform of an officer and highly polished black boots. He removed his cap and tucked it underneath his arm, revealing corn-coloured hair. His eyes were a penetrating blue, and his lips so thin they were scarcely visible.
"What is your name and number?" he asked courteously.
After Barney had given this information, he was asked where he was heading. "I am not obliged to tell you," he mumbled. Under the Geneva Convention, name and number were all that a prisoner was obliged to give. The officer smiled.
"If you were on your way to Saint-Valery-en-Caux, then your journey would have been a wasted one, Lieutenant Patterson. Today the German army took 8,000 British troops prisoner, including the general and their officers, together with about three times that many Frenchmen."
He snapped an order in his own language, and the soldiers grabbed their helmets, jackets and rifles and pushed and shoved their way out of the bar. Then he called,
"Oscar!"
And a middle-aged man wearing wire-framed spectacles marched in and saluted briskly. He regarded Barney with expressionless eyes. The officer spoke. Oscar nodded, saluted again and barked,
"Ja, mein Herr!"
and left the bar. Now there was only Barney and the officer left. The older man said,
"My name is Frederick Toller. I am colonel in the 7th Panzer Division of our glorious German army. If you are wondering why my English is so good, in the 20s I took a PhD in ancient Greek at Cambridge University. I was a history professor at Leipzig University when the war broke out, and I gave up the post to fight for my country. Did you go to university, Lieutenant?"
"I took a classics degree at Oxford." Barney saw no harm in revealing such an insignificant fact.
"I thought as much. You can always tell. A good degree gives a man a certain bearing."
He went over to the bar, picked up a wine bottle, and held it against the light to see how much was in it. Apparently satisfied, he rinsed one of the stone mugs under the tap and half-filled it.
"Would you like some, Lieutenant?" he inquired.
Barney shook his head. "No, thank you, but I would like to get out of these clothes. Your men clearly have no idea how to treat a prisoner of war." He said this with a confidence he didn't feel. It just seemed time he asserted himself in front of this senior officer.
"I apologize for my men," Colonel Toller said.
He genuinely sounded sorry.
"They will be told how to behave in future."
"I hadn't forgotten about your clothes. It so happens that I am on my way to Rouen and have a suitcase in my car.
Oscar will shortly bring in a change of clothing and arrange for what you are wearing to be laundered."
Oscar arrived at that very moment and put the clothes on a chair. A pair of white trousers, a white shirt and underwear. He placed a pair of white tennis shoes on the floor and left the bar without a word. Barney removed his shirt and singlet, put them in the sink, and let the water run over them. The red notebook was completely ruined.
He held it between finger and thumb and threw it on the floor. It didn't hold any military secrets. Anyway, the ink would have run and the writing would be illegible. He rinsed his hair and splashed himself from the waist up, using his hands. Three rags that might have been tea towels were hanging on hooks inside the bar. He took one and dried himself as best he could, then fetched the chair with the clean clothes so it was close to hand. At this point, Colonel Toller strolled into the room behind, while Barney removed his trousers and placed a leg at a time beneath the tap. What he would have liked was to stand underneath a steaming shower with a lump of carbolic soap and scrub himself until he was confident every trace of urine had gone. The colonel shouted, "Whoever lived here was quite a reader. What do you think of Tolstoy, Lieutenant Patterson?" "His books are too long," Barney shouted back. "At least that's what I thought when I was 17. I might not be so impatient now." "You are a very honest young man. How old are you?"
22, Barney replied. It was another piece of information that didn't seem all that important, and the colonel had told him enough about himself.
"Are you married?"
"Yes."
"Children?"
"Not yet, no."
"I have 5, 3 boys and 2 girls. My wife is English. Her name is Helena, and she comes from Brighton. Are you decent, Lieutenant? Can I come in?"
"I'm decent," said Barney. The trousers were too big around the waist and the shoes were too small, although the shirt and underwear fitted more or less. He felt much better, but could still smell urine. The colonel returned, smoking a cigarette. He still had the silver case in his hand and offered one to Barney, who took one gratefully, murmuring, "Thank you," when it was lit with a matching silver lighter.
"Leave your soiled clothes. Oscar will collect them," the colonel said. "Now, Lieutenant Patterson, you and I will travel together in a staff car to Rouen. We will have a civilized conversation about literature, say?"
He raised his fine eyebrows questioningly.
"I will put you on your honour not to try to escape, though the door on your side will be locked just in case you are not as honourable as you seem. I would be quite blatantly dishonourable were I in your position. I shall find out where the men who were captured this morning are being held and arrange for you to join them, though not until your clothes have been cleaned and dried and you have enjoyed a good meal."
He bowed and gestured to Barney to precede him from the bar.
"After you, Lieutenant. I think in different times we would have become good friends. But now the times are such that, as from this moment, you are officially a prisoner of war."
People weren't allowed to change their jobs in wartime unless they were transferring to one of equal importance. Amy didn't want to stay with London, Midland and Scottish Railways. She couldn't think of anything she could do that compared favourably with being the station master at Pond Wood. The line was in use again, but the station was closed for the foreseeable future. She didn't want to sell tickets, answer phones, or stand behind the desk in inquiries. She was neither big nor strong enough to become a porter, something she wouldn't have done anyway, even had she been 6 feet tall and as strong as Samson. "I want to get away from railways and do something completely different," she told Leo, who immediately offered her a job in his factory in Skelmersdale. "In a position of authority," he promised. "Is there a vacancy, or are you going to invent one?" She knew he didn't want his daughter-in-law doing something menial. He hadn't been keen on the job in Pond Wood, but she'd refused to be talked out of it. If she weren't careful, Leo would take control of her life. He actually had the nerve to be cross if she wasn't in when he telephoned or turned up unexpectedly. She told him bluntly she wasn't prepared to be at his beck and call. "I'll go out whenever I want, Leo, to wherever I like." She turned down the job in Skelmersdale, not wanting to be answerable to him in any way. He came up with another. A friend of his was opening an Army, Navy and Air Force club in the basement of a building in Water Street and wanted a receptionist. "I told him about you, and he's really keen. It'd mean getting dressed up to the nines every night. There's plenty of time to buy some pretty evening frocks before clothes are rationed." His dark eyes danced with mischief. He knew it would appeal to her. Amy was sorely tempted. It was the sort of job she'd love.
Buying clothes was her favourite occupation. She was about to accept when Leo revealed the club would be for officers only. Other ranks wouldn't be allowed in.
"That means, Harry, your own son would be banned," she said, and told him she wasn't prepared to go near the place. "The privates and corporals are just as important to the war as the officers."
"I didn't know you were a socialist, Amy," he said. She eyed him suspiciously, having no idea what the word meant.
"Well, I am,"
she said stoutly, hoping she wasn't making a fool of herself. In the end, Amy went to work in the canteen of the Mulholland Car Manufacturing Company in Speak, after seeing the job advertised in the Echo. The only cars turned out nowadays were for the forces. She'd worked in a canteen before and had the right experience. Buses left from various parts of Liverpool to collect the workers. One stopped in Shiel Road, only a short walk from the flat. She would work shifts from 6 a.m. until 2 p.m. and from 2 p.m. until 10 p.m. alternate weeks. The morning shift went in on Saturdays. The afternoon one had Saturday off. Leo said she was wasted in the job. She asked him what was so special about her.
"I'm just an ordinary person like everyone else," she said.
"No, you're not, Amy," he said quite seriously, without his usual grin. "You really are special." The words worried her. She had tried valiantly not to think the unthinkable, but after he'd said that, she found it impossible not to be concerned that Leo Patterson was attracted to her. Even worse, instead of being shocked, she felt flattered. He was, without doubt, an extremely attractive man. Her sisters thought he was the bee's knees, even Jackie, who was now madly in love with Peter Alton. Amy's first day at Mulholland's was an afternoon shift, and that morning she received her first letter from Barney in months. He was in a prisoner of war camp in Germany in an area called Bavaria. It wasn't a very long letter. He'd write to her again, he promised, as soon as he'd settled in, and tell her what had happened over the last few months. Amy had a thick wad of letters waiting to send him via the Red Cross, as she'd been writing nearly every day without having anywhere to send them. Parts of Barney's letter had been crossed out. Leo said the censor had done it. She'd let him read most of the letter, apart from the last page, where Barney told her how much he loved and missed her. "He or she must have considered it sensitive information," Leo said.
"Cheek," Amy snorted. "What a terrible job to have, reading other people's letters and crossing bits out."
"Some people might find it interesting."
"They're nothing but nosy parkers. It's worse than being a spy."
So it was a much happier Amy who turned up in Mulholland's canteen that afternoon. The four other women who worked there, Gladys, Em, Tossie and Joan, whose ages ranged from 25 to 60, weren't exactly taken with the pretty young woman in her smart red linen frock and black patent high-heeled shoes, who looked as if she hadn't done a hard day's work in her entire life. As Em, the 25-year-old, explained later,
"We thought you were some posh bitch who was showing off to her friends by working with the riffraff."
"I forgot to get changed," Amy confessed with a tinkling laugh when she first got there, and Gladys, age 60, asked gruffly if she was sure she'd come to the right place.
"The cocktail lounge is upstairs," she said with a loud sniff.
The women's rude words and contemptuous glances went over Amy's head. She'd had a letter from Barney and nothing else mattered.
"I heard from my husband this morning for the first time in ages," she explained excitedly. "I was told he'd been taken prisoner not long after Dunkirk, and I've been desperately waiting for a letter ever since."
"Oh, what sort of urn is that?"
"The canteen where I were before had a gas one, but it was forever blowing out. It was awful dangerous. Every time it was lit, we expected the place to blow up. Is that one electric?"
The fact that Amy's husband was a prisoner of war would have been enough to make the women take her to their hearts, but she had worked in a canteen before and made no claim to be better than they were, only made them like her more. Before the day was out, they were the best of friends. Amy went home at 10 o'clock, every part of her body throbbing painfully, even though Joan, who seemed to be in charge, had found her a sitting-down job, rolling out several miles of short-cut pastry and cutting it into circles for jam tarts.
She had learned that Joan's husband was in the Merchant Navy and that she was having terrible trouble with her 15-year-old daughter, who was going out with a chap twice her age. Em, unmarried, looked after two very elderly aunts, and Tossie was a widow in her 30s, who, due to the war, was having the time of her life.
"I never thought the day would come when I'd go dancing again," she told Amy when they were having their mid-afternoon break. "I'm earning more money than I've ever known in me life. I get me hair done every week. If me husband were alive, he'd bloody kill me. He hated me having a good time, did Ron?"
Gladys was a grumpy soul who only saw the black side of life. Yet it was obvious the other women were extremely fond of her. They made fun of her gloomy face and ill humour. When she got home, Amy lay in the bath and let the throbbing ebb away until she felt numb instead. Tomorrow she could sleep in as late as she liked, or she could get up early and go shopping. She could do with a pair of flat shoes. Was it possible to get really smart, flat shoes? She boiled milk for Coco and read Barney's letter again. The cocoa drunk, she climbed into bed, clutching the letter. Barney had actually touched it. She pressed the sheets against her lips. "Barney," she whispered. "Oh, Barney." Amy was working much harder than she'd done in Pondwood, yet she had more free time. She had forgotten what it was like to shop leisurely, to go to the pictures or out for a meal. All sorts of wonderful films had come out while she'd been buried in Pond Wood. Dark Victory and The Old Maid with Bette Davis, Ninotchka with Greta Garbo, and the most wonderful film that had ever been made, Gone with the Wind, starring Clark Gable and Vivien Leigh and loads of other famous stars. Amy went to see them all with Em, who was mad on the pictures and familiar with the life story of every famous film star. "My friend Kathy had a big crush on Clark Gable," she said to Em when they came out of the picture house. "I must write and ask if she's seen Gone with the Wind. She'd love it." Kathy wrote back to say she'd seen the film, but no longer had a crush on Clark Gable. "I was only young then," she wrote, as if at 19 she was as old as the hills. "He's dead handsome, but I prefer real flesh and blood men, not the celluloid sort." The air raids began to get more and more frequent. Captain Kirby Green and Mr. and Mrs. Porter, the elderly couple who lived on the first floor of the house in Newsham Park, had turned the spacious cellar into a shelter fit for royalty. Armchairs had appeared like magic, as well as a coffee table, a battery wireless that could still function if the electricity supply was lost, a camping stove for making hot drinks, an assortment of books, the provision of which had been taken over by the captain, who haunted second-hand bookshops for tales with a nautical bent. There were two biographies of Nelson and detailed descriptions of sea battles going back hundreds of years. The porters made their way down to the cellar at around 8 o'clock every evening. That's if the air raid siren hadn't already sounded. She armed with her knitting and he with an assortment of newspapers to read, including the damned socialist ones. "I don't suppose it hurts to get the other person's point of view," he would say grudgingly, in defence of his purchase of such left-wing trash. The captain, always anxious for someone to talk to, would be listening for the click of the cellar door rather than the siren and would immediately follow. Clive and Veronica Stafford, who lived on the second floor, were both tall and bony, with insipid features and pale blue eyes. They could easily have been taken for brother and sister, a likeness helped by the fact that both wore rimless glasses. They nearly always arrived in the middle of an argument over something that Clive considered was Veronica's fault. He'd forgotten to take a handkerchief to work. He'd been too hot or cold in bed the night before. His fountain pen had run out of ink. One of his shoelaces had snapped. Veronica should have noticed it was beginning to fray. Veronica would point out that the shoe had been on his foot, not hers. He was the last to use the pen, and how on earth was she supposed to keep track of the ink? He should have noticed there wasn't a handkerchief in his jacket pocket. She had been asleep when he had been too hot or cold in bed, and therefore there was nothing she could have done about it.
"You should be more alert, V."
Clive didn't like to lose an argument.
"I'll do my best in future," Veronica would say, or something like it,
a tinge of sarcasm in her voice that her husband didn't notice. She would also make a hideous face behind his back as soon as he turned away. She told Amy that she hoped Clive would be called up one day.
He needs to learn that there are more important things to worry about than missing hankies and frayed shoelaces, she said.
Mrs. Curran and Amy worked the same shifts. Sometimes Amy went straight from Mulholland's to Agate Street and spent the afternoon with her mam, or they went shopping together in Strand Road, Bootle, or South Road in Waterloo. It was late October when Amy arrived at her own home and found, for the first time ever, Mam waiting for her. She'd been captured by Captain Kirby Green and was in his living room drinking very strong tea and eating fig biscuits when Amy went in.
"He must have used up all his tea ration," Mam whispered as she and Amy went upstairs, the captain very reluctant to let her go. "I wonder where he got the fig biscuits from. They've always been me favourite."
"I suppose you can guess what's happened," she said a few minutes later, when she was having a cup of very weak tea provided by Amy, who didn't have a single biscuit in the flat. When Amy confessed she hadn't the faintest idea what had happened, she went on.
"Our Jackie and Peter only want to get married. Trouble is, he isn't a Catholic, though he's perfectly willing to change. His mam and dad don't mind. I've already met them, and they're really nice."
"Then what's the problem?"
"They want to get married straight away, that's the problem," Mam sighed. "Jackie's only 17 and she needs my permission to get married. She can't do it behind me back like you did."
"I'm sorry, love, but it's true, isn't it?" she said when her daughter opened her mouth to argue.
"I suppose so," Amy was obliged to concede.
She'd waited until her 18th birthday, but Jackie had a whole year to go before she was 18.
"There's no suppose about it, Amy, but we won't go into that right now. It's all over and done with. All I'm concerned about is our Jackie. Peter would have been called up ages ago, except his dad needed him on the farm, but at Peter's insistence, his dad got someone else to help, leaving him free to join the forces."
"I don't know," Mrs. Curran said irritably.
"None of me kids get married normally. Our Charlie married a really weird woman who hasn't got a single relative in the world. You married a Protestant in one of them heathen register office places, and now our Jackie's about to do the same. There isn't time for Peter to take instruction and become a Catholic. What the hell am I supposed to do, Amy? Should I let her get married or not?"
She put the cup and saucer on the floor and lit a cigarette.
"I'm smoking myself silly," she said. "I should be smoking less, not more. The last time I bought a pack of ciggies, I had virtually to prostrate myself on the floor in front of Ernie McIlvany before he'd sell me them."
Ernie McIlvany ran the sweet and tobacconist shop on the corner of Agate Street and Marsh Lane.
"Once the war's over, I shall never go near his bloody shop again."
"Let them get married," Amy said promptly. "Our Jackie would never forgive you if Peter was killed and they hadn't been able to marry." There was a surefire way of making her mother give permission. Just imagine if Peter went away and Jackie found she was pregnant.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," her mother crossed herself. "That'd never do. Oh, all right then, I'll tell the pair of them to go ahead."
She sighed. Amy suspected she'd been resigned to the marriage all along and had known Amy would back her up. Jackie Curran became Mrs. Peter Alton on the final Saturday in 1940. During the nights leading up to Christmas, tons of bombs had fallen on Liverpool, incendiary and high explosives and mines. At times it had appeared as if the entire city was on fire, the flames reaching into the sky and turning it a sinister blood red. Hundreds of people were killed and many famous Liverpool landmarks were destroyed or damaged. After so much carnage and horror, it was with a sense of relief that the residents of Agate Street turned out to watch Jackie Curran leave the house to get married to a lovely young man who'd just joined the Royal Navy. She looked so young and pretty in her blue tweed costume and little feathered hat. It was a brave thing to do, taking on a husband in the middle of a terrible war, perhaps even starting a family. Jackie wasn't getting married in a church as she would have in normal times. But times were anything but normal, and the young couple were keen to get married in a hurry. God wouldn't mind that they would only be wed in the eyes of the law and not in his. Nowadays everything had to be done in a hurry. A person couldn't go to bed and expect to be alive the next morning. If you left your house, you couldn't be sure it would still be standing when you got back. Nothing was certain anymore. The only certainty lay in the present, so you had to live for the moment, just in case tomorrow never came. At least, not for you.
Kathy came home the day after the wedding. She'd been hoping to be there in time, but the trains had been all over the place, and she'd spent the night in the ladies' waiting room at Preston Station. She came to Agate Street wearing civvies, as her man was pressing her uniform in readiness for her to go back. Mrs. Burns was desperately proud of her youngest daughter, who'd been promoted to Lance Corporal and boasted a stripe on the sleeves of her khaki jacket. Mrs. Curran provided a lovely tea with leftovers from the reception and a tin of ham. The house seemed strange without Jackie, who was on honeymoon with Peter in the Lake District. Poor Biddy looked so lost that Amy invited her to come to the pictures with her and Kathy that night.
"Thank you, sis," Biddy said with a pathetic sniff.
After that, Amy and Kathy went into the parlour to catch up. They wrote often, but the last time they'd seen each other was right after Amy had lost her baby.
"I still think about it," Amy said sadly. "He or she would be 9 months old by now. Every time I see a baby, I wish it were mine."
"There'll be plenty of time to have another." Kathy's eyes were full of warmth, and Amy thought what a good friend she was, always had been.
"How's Jack?" she asked.
"He's in North Africa with Harry Patterson."
"Of course, I'd forgotten they were friends."
"Comrades," Jack calls them. "Comrades in arms." Kathy smiled shyly.
"I haven't told you yet, but we're engaged. I haven't got a ring, but we're going to get married as soon as he comes home."
"Oh, Kathy, I'm dead pleased," Amy cried. "But why didn't you get married while he was still in England?"
"We didn't realise how much we meant to each other until he was in Africa," Kathy said dreamily. "He proposed to me in a letter. For a while, I thought you might end up with Harry Patterson. I remember you said he came to see you the Christmas before last, and you got on really well."
"We did," Kathy looked puzzled. "I've always liked Harry, ever since the day we met on Southport Pier. And I liked him even better after he came to see me in Keighley. Afterwards, he sent me a sort of love letter, and I wrote back, but then I never heard from him again."
"Not that it matters," she sighed joyfully. "It's Jack I love, not Harry."
Amy felt very emotional.
"Wouldn't it be the gear if we both had babies at the same time?"
Her face fell.
"Though the chances of you seeing Jack are much better than the chances of me seeing Barney. It could be years and years before this stupid war is over and he comes home."
"You never know, Amy. Miracles can happen." Amy managed half a smile.
"Can I be a bridesmaid at your wedding?"
"You can be matron of honour." Kathy gave no hint at how hurt she'd been when Amy had married Barney without saying a word to her, her best friend. That was in the past, and she'd never been one to cry over spilt milk. Harry Patterson lay stretched out and completely still on the canvas bed. He was lying on top of the bedclothes, and all he wore was a pair of cotton underpants. Despite this, perspiration was dribbling out of every pore, and he felt unpleasantly and uncomfortably damp. The hot weather didn't agree with him. It was something he hadn't realised until he arrived in North Africa in August and experienced temperatures unknown in the British Isles. He discovered he was susceptible to the sun and burnt horribly if he got too much of it, his skin erupting in ugly blisters. Fortunately, the army was sympathetic, and he was allowed to work under canvas for most of the time. This meant he had peeled an awful lot of spuds, as the men called them, and washed an awful lot of dishes. He wondered what his father would say if he knew. Would he care that one of his sons was engaged in such menial tasks? Harry somehow doubted it. Dad might care if it were Barney, but not him. Trouble with nights like this, when sleep was impossible and he found it hard to breathe, he couldn't stop himself from thinking dark thoughts. The darkest of them all was wondering why on earth he'd told Jack Wilkinson that he wasn't interested in Kathy Burns. "She's a nice girl," he'd said.
I really like her, but it's not serious. It had happened just after Dunkirk. While Harry kicked his heels in Essex, Jack had been sent back to Leeds to have his ankle seen to. At first it was thought to be broken, but it had turned out to be just a bad sprain. Jack had written to him.
Remember that girl you met in Keighley at Christmas? Gabby something. Is it serious between you two? There's a dance over there on Saturday, but at the moment I can only dance on one leg. I'm not looking to seduce her, but I remember you saying you had loads to talk about, and it would be great to meet a girl I can hold a conversation with.
Kathy and I are just friends, Harry wrote back. Her surname is Burns, and she's in the finance office. I'm sure she'll be pleased to see you. Jack didn't write again, and Harry got the shock of his life when his friend had rejoined his unit, now in Siren Acre, his ankle mended, and with the news that he thought he was in love with Kathy Burns.
"She's a cracking girl," he said, rubbing his thin hands together joyfully.
He punched Harry's shoulder so hard that Harry winced.
"Thanks, old chap. That's the biggest favour anyone's ever done for me. I'll be grateful